Okay, everyone, thanks for coming. I'm Mike Green from CSIS and Georgetown University. And we're very happy today to introduce to you Maria Toyoda, who is here at CSIS for the second of a two-week, the second of two one-week periods of research here under what we have started as the Japan Policy Fellowship. And the aim of the fellowship is to identify rising stars in the field of Japan studies, but from different disciplines. So far, we've had all political scientists, in fact, but we're interdisciplinary in our approach, and to try to take advantage of what is really cutting-edge research and thinking about Japan's role in the world. Japan's role in Asia, U.S.-Japan relations. The benefit for the Washington policy community, for CSIS, is that we get to borrow, I won't say steal, and cite all of these important works. We generally try to get people who are assistant or junior-level associate professors because I was once one of those, and that's often when the best work is and most original and cutting-edge work is coming out for people. And we wanted to make sure that people at that point in their career in the academy who are often under enormous scheduling pressures, managing departments or preparing for tenure or trying to get a second book out, whatever the case may be, they have relatively little time to step out of the university and share some of their insights with policymakers. So we wanted to create an opportunity for that, and also give people from the academic side an opportunity to see what government's doing on the subject. Sometimes it's impressive for our fellows. Sometimes it's not impressive at all. But we want to sort of have a two-way discussion that hopefully after a week or two here creates a network and contacts that are beneficial for people inside the Beltway who tend to be more focused on short-term, immediate issues, people in the academy who are diving deeper into some of these questions. And we've been pretty pleased so far, and we think we've built a pretty good network. We've been imitated by the Mansfield Foundation, which has now set up a group of younger scholars for the same purpose, and we think it will really benefit everybody involved, and we're very grateful to Maria for joining us. Some of you may have heard Maria yesterday. She was on the panel on East Asian integration in our annual CSIS JETRO conference on Asian economic issues. She's an associate professor at Villanova and chair of the political science department, which I guess this week is in complete chaos and mayhem while you're away. As long as they don't take your office. She is a Stanford PhD and a Georgetown grad, so she knows Washington pretty well. This is not a new thing for her. Philadelphia is not all that far away, where Villanova is. She's been a Council on Foreign Relations Hitachi Fellow, which is a very prestigious program at the Council for, similar in a way to what we're trying to do, taking policy people and putting them in a university in Japan or a think tank, or taking academics and putting them in policy. What Maria did was work for JBIC, Japan Bank for International Cooperation, which, of course, is the at the center of her research topic, which is Japan's overseas financial and development policy, the politics of financial liberalizations. She's worked on postal savings. And I think thanks to Kami Shizuka, that will probably all be reversed, and then you can do another project on postal savings reform. And is going to talk to us today about the topic behind me. why don't we, since it's a manageable size group and there's a lot of expertise around the table, do a jiko shokai, if that's okay, and then we'll turn it over to Maria. Why don't we start with you, Nick, and we'll go around. Jiko shokai is self-introduction.
I'm Nick Seicheni. I'm Deputy Director of the Japan Chair and a fellow here at CSIS.
Good morning. I'm Kane Uchikura, a Visiting Fellow at the Brookings.
Hi, I'm Bob Hershey. I'm a consultant. I also did a book which explains investment to people and calculations, which is translated into Japanese.
Susan Taylor, Sojitz Corporation.
From JICA?
Anjavik.
Kyoto Tsuji, Japan Chair CSIS.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Gong Keyu. I'm a Vietnamese scholar in Frame Chair CSIS, and I'm in Shanghai Institute for International Studies. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Chisako Fukuda. I work for the World Bank in External Affairs, Donor Relations with Japan and Korea. So this is a perfect topic for me.
Good.
Looking forward
Good.
To it. Thank you.
Give her ideas how to get more money out of Japan.
Hi, I'm Chen, Military Fellow here.
And I'm Tom Ok, Bank of Tokyo, Mitsubishi UFJ, the Japanese private sector bank. Thank you.
You're the photographer?
I'm Taylor. I'm with External Relations here at CSIS.
I get the picture.
I'm Sarah
Heidner.
I work for Market News International.
I'm Mary Beth Weil. I work with the Southeast Asia program here at CSIS.
Andrew No, Clark Associates.
Okay, we're over here. Right. I'm going to get out of the way because you're using PowerPoint.
That's right. I'll just treat this like a classroom, like a seminar.
I mean, it'll be a test.
It'll be like a graduate seminar, just a very short quiz at the end.
Thanks. Mike, Nick, thank you so much. I know Ari's not in the room, but I also wanted to thank Ari very much for making me feel so welcome. They don't let us out of our cages very often where I'm from, so this has been a very welcome opportunity to get out. I know that Washington is not the real world, but it does feel like that to me sometimes when you're in the bubble. I also wanted to support, no one here is from the Center for Global Partnership, but they are co-sponsoring this with CSIS, and we should mention that as well. I'm going to talk as a political scientist today, and I think that's the comparative advantage that I can bring to the discussion today, because many of you already are Japan experts, and there's no need for me to explain to you how things generally work in Japan. But I'm going to try to bring a perspective from my field on some of the problems that I see in the scholarship in the field of ODA and looking at economic cooperation in general. And that's why I entitled this talk Economic Cooperation Redux, because in a way I think it's time to go back and look again at what we mean when we talk about economic cooperation. And I think that there's a need to be much more precise about terminology, because I think a lot of recent scholarship has been negatively affected by, I think, an imprecision in the ways in which we define our terms. So part of the talk is sort of a meta talk about the difficulties of doing scholarly work in this area when we don't have a firm grip on what we mean when we're talking about things like ODA, foreign aid, development assistance, economic cooperation. This is a perspective, again, from somebody who is in a very strange department, right? The political science department, as Mike knows, is a strange kind of academic department, because on the one hand, everything that we need to do in order to get hired, to get promoted, to get published even, has to do with these little minutiae that have to do with methods and research design and those sorts of things. But on the other hand, as a political science department, we purport to know something about real life, right? And we purport to be able to provide knowledge to policymakers and practitioners and by giving them new information that might that would be useful to them as policy inputs. I don't think we do a very good job of this. And I think that the reason why we haven't been doing such a good job of this lately in the field, anyway, of development assistance is because we ourselves have been very bad about defining what exactly it is that we're studying. So the key points that I wanted to make, the one point here that I just mentioned is that the imprecision about the terms about something like aid effectiveness has really limited the scholarship. I'll try to, expound on that a little bit more. Second, I think the other big point that I would like to make is that in light of a growing uncertainty and doubt about the effects of aid in general and the effects of certain types of aid more specifically, the international aid community's judgments about aid quality need to be further scrutinized. I think that we've sort of reached an impasse in the field. And I think it's time to scrutinize just exactly what we mean when we say we measure aid effectiveness and aid quality. And the last thing the last major point I want to make today is that despite the sort of criticisms that Japan routinely gets about its aid policy, Japan's aid system has transformed over time. Japan's actually quite realist in the way that it approaches aid, and it's been transformed over time partly because of international pressure. But it's also transformed because of domestic political rifts and variations in time of ministerial power over foreign aid policy. Just to give you a quick idea of how this fits into my work, I started getting interested in this when I was postal savings for academics is a gift that keeps giving. I mean, it's never resolved. But its connection to the fiscal investment and loan program, the Zeitel program, actually was the first thing that led me to looking at some of this, because so much of aid, when I started looking at this, was funded through the postal savings program. And then a second stream of work that I'm doing on this is more quantitative work on the relationship between capital account liberalization and economic growth, looking at just what the determinants of economic growth are, feed in again into this interest that I have in development assistance and poverty reduction. So let me talk a little bit about it's a quick little digression into the terminology here. The use of the term economic cooperation goes back to the early post-war years in Japan, after the completion of the San Francisco Peace Treaty, which largely absolved Japan of making formal wartime reparations. The alternative was that Japan would make informal reparations with treaties that involved development assistance. And as one of the speakers mentioned yesterday, this was actually quite a vital function for Japan to play in the 1950s and really gave the seeds of Asian integration, East Asian economic integration, because with Japan's foreign assistance in the form of not just finance but also its production networks, this led to a critical mass of economic and productive activity in the region. So economic cooperation, just widely understood, really is an old concept in the region, and it encompasses everything. It's not just foreign aid. It's investment. It's not just official. It's also private. It's not just formal. It's also informal, right? So there are multiple players, multiple integrative functions here. It's not just finance, it's investment and productive capabilities and a number of other things that go into that. The U.S. itself favored this term back in the early post-war period. In fact, it was the Economic Cooperation Act, which was approved by Congress in 1948, that allowed the U.S. to implement the Marshall Plan through the Economic Cooperation Administration, which was set up to administer the plan. So since then, however, the term economic cooperation has sort of fallen out of favor. And it's been replaced by a number of other terms that I think were meant to clarify exactly what certain types of economic cooperation were, but I think in other ways have clouded what we mean when we talk about economic cooperation. So an example of this would be development assistance, and this is a more general term that has to do with foreign assistance that is given for the purpose of boosting economic growth, right? This is not necessarily humanitarian relief or emergency relief, disaster relief, that sort of thing. This is quite different from development assistance, which looks specifically at measures that, that donor countries would take in order to boost the prospects of economic growth. And so when we talk about poverty reduction in that sense of the term, then this is a very narrow concept. It's not just poverty. There's been some interesting work done recently, for instance, in Africa, which looks, of course, at the sub-Saharan region. And just on a pure GDP basis, on a growth basis, Africa has really fallen behind. So from a development perspective, Africa is failing if you look at it in terms of pure economic growth. But if you look at development as other indicators, right, such as increasing, you know, life spans or infant mortality, if you remove the impact, for instance, of HIV/AIDS, right, and you look at some other measures in Africa that, that have to do with other aspects of standard of living that are separate, really, from just pure per capita income, that region actually has made progress since the 1960s. And so it's really difficult to say, for instance, whether, you know, a country is developing if you, if you're not being more precise about what you mean by development, right? So on a pure per capita GDP basis, Africa is not doing that well. But in terms of other measures, maybe it's doing a little bit better than it would otherwise appear to be. The most the narrowest definition of all is this ODA, Official Development Assistance, and this is what you hear most policymakers. This is a term most policymakers throw around because they are interested. Again, you don't. This is not meant for you to read, but this is the official definition of ODA. At least as far as the OECD Development Assistance Committee defines. And it's really quite specific about what proportion of a, for instance, a yen loan or a euro loan, you know, what portion of it refers to a grant. And there's certain ways of calculating. You can calculate it as net ODA, as gross ODA. It's they're very complicated formulas to come up with ODA figures. So let me first talk about the defining characteristics of ODA. Many of you will be familiar with this, but I'm just highlighting a few things that sort of make Japanese ODA stand out compared to other countries, donor countries. One is that there's a heavy emphasis on concessional yen loans, more so than proportionally than any other country in the world. And then if you look at just the yen loan program in isolation, it's the largest of its kind in the world. Right? This is one area where Japan gets a lot of flack because yen loans are loans. Right? Those of you who work with the World Bank or any of the regional development banks will know that in many ways you have to operate like a business. You do have to get paid back and so forth. Nevertheless, because of the amount of debt that developing countries take on, this is usually considered an indicator of poor aid in terms of quality. I'm going to argue later that I don't think that's so. But a second major characteristic of that sets the Japanese aid regime apart from others is that it is based on request. That is, Japan itself does not engage in a programmatic review every year. I mean, it does at the level of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, but it's not in the same way that, for instance, the State Department and the USAID plan their programs out every year or every 3 years. There's no matrix of, you know, things that that Japan would have to hit. There are no country-specific sorts of programs that the Japanese ODA system puts into place. Rather, the traditional concept has been that Japan is open to tenders and proposals from the recipient countries themselves. And working in partnership with the recipient countries, usually through field offices or in the case where field offices are not present, through the embassies or consulates, that a suitable proposal will be made that then is sent up to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which works with the Ministry of Finance in order to come up with an annual budget. and then it's eventually dispersed through agencies like JICA. So the request basis has actually been a key foundation of Japanese aid over the years. The third thing, which is again tied to this idea of concessional yen loans, is that there's heavy emphasis on infrastructure and projects, project-based financing. There's a great love of cement, as you know, many of you from Japan, and those who travel in Japan know they like to tile everything, and there's a great love of cement. But this is actually, you know, again, if you look at the request-based nature of ODA, this is what recipients are requesting. At least on a dollar-to-dollar basis at any given point, a recipient country, at least the ones that Japan has the closest relations with, and these would be the Asian countries, the largest demand really comes from the need for project-based infrastructural finance. A couple more here. Another important principle that Japanese ODA began with was a principle of non-interference in domestic affairs of recipient countries. Now, this is not a perfect principle in a sense, because Japan does intervene when pressed to do so, or when it finds that its national interests are not being met. But in principle, over time, Japan prefers not to take aggressive measures against countries that you know, that might buck international norms. So there is a general reluctance on the part of Japan not to interfere in the domestic affairs, political affairs especially, of recipient countries. And then a fifth characteristic is that so much of a great deal of Japanese aid, probably more than many would think, is dispersed through the multilateral international financial institutions. So this, Japan has the largest share and the presidency of the Asian Development Bank. It is a major share, one of the major shareholders in the IMF and the World Bank, but also the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the Inter-American Development Bank. It holds stakes in the African Development Bank. So Japan is clearly a leader in terms of dispersing its aid through these multilateral institutions. These special characteristics have singled Japan out for criticism, because it does run counter to many of the trends that we've seen in amongst the international donor community over the years. But the criticism of Japanese aid is really nothing new. I mean, it really goes back to the days when Japan even began, joining in on international debates about aid. Overview of what people have said in the past about whether or not Japan has an aid philosophy. If you go back to the 1970s, you had this guy, Alan Ricks, who had written and studied Japanese ODA extensively. And he came to the conclusion that there is no aid philosophy in Japan. It stresses obligation rather than altruism. And sort of following up on that sort of cultural argument, you have a guy like Carl Van Wolferen coming out of the school of revisionists in the 1980s, just baldly saying that Japan is incapable of selfless gestures. And this goes back to again, the sort of cultural punditry coming out of that era that basically said, well, you know, Japan doesn't have a culture of philanthropy. There aren't any Christian values and so forth. And that's why Japan is unable to behave as if it's a moral imperative to give aid. I find that just sort of a tasteless argument myself. And I don't actually find later critiques of Japanese aid to be that much better, even though it's not based on something I don't know, as inflammatory as cultural comparisons. But even the more recent work in the 90s done by good political scientists like Dennis Yasutomo made the conclusion that Japan's aid was largely strategic, right? And in Yasutomo's case, he's saying it's strategic from the perspective of commercial interests, business interests in Japan. And where I find that a little lacking as well is that, well, who isn't strategic about giving aid? And, you know, isn't aid, in a way, supposed to be strategic, right? Whether or not, how do you disentangle, for instance, the strategic aims of a country like Japan from the desire on the part of its recipients to grow? And especially, you know, we've spent the week talking about East Asian integration and how important it is for Asia to grow for Japan. To me, it's hard to disentangle motives from the actual outcomes. And I think that's one of the problems that has sort of muddied the waters in the scholarship on Japanese aid is this assigning of motives, right? Assigning of motives without actually asking people, you know, what your motives are, without actually trying to disentangle the motives from the actual outcomes, and also trying to impose a particular view of what, you know, for instance, the aid community might consider to be good aid, right, versus poor quality aid. Nevertheless, over time, Japan has bowed to pressure, international pressure, to better define what it means when it means that it gives aid through philosophical motives. It has tried to define its philosophy in a way that I think captures both the strategic elements to explain why Japan makes aid strategically. So, for instance, why Japan would favor giving aid to its neighbors in the Asia region. They've tried to explain why it is that it would favor aid that goes, for instance, towards middle-income countries rather than the poorest countries. And it has tried to also explain why it is that its aid is biased, again, towards these large-scale projects rather than maybe more targeted poverty reduction schemes, right? It hasn't done a very good job of explaining this, obviously, because it's still a target of a great deal of criticism. But I think it's worth looking at how these explanations have changed over time. One of the watershed years here for when Japan had to feel like it had to explain itself to the rest of the aid community was when it joined the OECD and therefore acceded to the Development Assistance Group, which is today DAC. Development Assistance Committee in 1964. Its accession to DAC was a key event in terms of Japan becoming socialized into the usage of terms such as aid, development assistance, and economic cooperation, and then also becoming socialized to the larger ideas of what constituted good quality aid. Or even altruistic aid. This is when Japan starts to learn the language of altruism. It's not comfortable with the language of altruism because I think that, you know, that again, the realist elements within the Japanese bureaucracy, I think, have won out each and every time. Nevertheless, you can see that there are changes in the language within official documents starting in 1964, and this learning process, you can actually visualize this over time. If you were to do some content analysis of the major documents related to ODA. One of the major documents, of course, that have come out of this whole national conversation about aid in Japan comes out in 1992 with the publishing of Japan's first ODA charter, which is for the first time a general statement about what aid is about. And let me give you a couple of the highlights here that I think looking at a little bit more closely is the political environment in which the ODA charter was written. One of the things, of course, was this comes in the aftermath of ODA scandals, particularly involving Marcos in the Philippines and the corruption scandals related to that. So there was increased public awareness and increasing public opposition. You know, aid is never, in any country, unless maybe you're in the Nordic group, is not exactly a salient political issue. But there are these issues that came up in the 80s that increased public scrutiny and increased opposition to Japanese aid. This was at a point when Japan had just surpassed the U.S. as the number one ODA donor back in 1989. And so there was a heightened awareness about ODA. This is also a point where there were structural changes in the Japanese economy. The bubble economy had burst, and that also led to greater scrutiny and opposition to foreign aid. There was heightened international scrutiny. Japan was now a major power within ODA. And as the number one donor, world donor, it's going to be subject to a lot more international scrutiny. So the Ministry of Foreign Affairs thought it was especially critical at that point to issue a general statement of principle about ODA. And, of course, the other major contextual part of this is that the ODA charter was written in a much more complex global environment following the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War. Prior to the collapse of the Soviet Union, it was fairly easy for Japan to pursue its economic strategic aims through aid as long as it was a system supporter. Right. Its entry into places, for instance, like South Africa, was not strongly criticized at the time because this was part of a larger programmatic effort on the part of the United States to combat communism in places like Africa. So there was a much more complicated international environment and complex environment in which Japan had to state its purpose here. Within Japan, domestically, the conversation went like this. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs, at the time of following the release of the 1992 ODA Charter, felt that it was necessary to formulate an international development strategy. This is, again, because of pressure from other donors through the OECD, who wanted Japan, again, to be much more precise and clear about its aims and what its motives were behind ODA. They wanted a statement of principle from Japan, and they wanted the Japanese to build on the principles of the 1992 ODA Charter. Now, some of the elements here that we're talking about are increasing support for democratization. So that's natural, right, following upon the collapse of the Soviet Union. Human rights was another issue that was highlighted in the 1992 ODA Charter. And then a third element, which is a little bit, I think, puzzling in some way, and that's something that I'd like to look at a little bit more closely, but it was a statement about Japan's unwillingness to continue making foreign aid to countries that did not restrain their military spending. Now, this is a statement that no other OECD country had made. But here is Japan, you know, just sort of throwing that in, right? Now, was it actually enforced? No. I mean, it wasn't really enforced. There were a couple of times, for instance, in the early 90s, when, the increase in the Chinese military budget prompted Japan to send a notification, please understand that we give ODA using the principles of our charter, and therefore we ask that you respect that. I mean, but the language was not very strong, and this was really just in a sense a notification. And ODA to China did not end until really just a couple of years ago. Right? So these are interesting in a number of ways. I think this reflects, in a way, a couple of the domestic issues, particularly having to do with bureaucratic and ministerial power over the ODA policy here. I won't go into too much detail about these other things, but this is a just examples of some of the domestic conversations going on in Japan at that point. I want to instead lay out for you what some of the key positions were, at least from a ministerial point of view. In a lot of ways, both the 1992 ODA Charter and the revision of the Charter in 2003 were products of a bureaucratic struggle, right, within the Japan. Japan has a divided bureaucracy. Well, a lot of countries have a divided bureaucracy when it comes to ODA. But in Japan, the bureaucracies that were in charge of ODA were also the strongest bureaucracies. Right? They're the most powerful bureaucracies. So you have the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, you have MITI, now METI, and you have the Ministry of Finance, all deeply engaged through the 90s in the process of making ODA policy. The driving force here is the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. If you want to think about where the international pressure comes from, it's really coming primarily through the channel of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and their representatives, for instance, to the OECD, to World Bank, to IMF, to the major multilateral institutions, to the Paris Club, to the Berne Conventions, and so forth. So it's the Ministry of Foreign Affairs that is the main conduit for international pressure at this time. And it was the Ministry of Foreign Affairs really pushing for a clearer articulation of ODA and pushing for reform of ODA to more closely allow Japanese ODA to converge with sort of the general norms of the international aid community. So MOFA worked during the 90s to build a lot of what were called these common agenda donor alliances. So these were donor alliances on a bilateral basis with a number of countries that it saw eye to eye with. So the strongest linkages being made at this point were, for instance, Japan and Germany, Japan and France, Japan and Australia. Again, countries that Japan had what it saw as a more common aid philosophy, right? And also places where I think Japan felt that it wasn't being too harshly criticized in the ways in which it was giving aid. Ultimately, all these efforts resulted in the formulation of an ODA policy and a set of guidelines in 1999 that the cabinet then began to follow. The main bureaucratic struggle here occurs between the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and MITI, and it was really over national interest, right, and national interest writ large. Having to do with security, U.S.-Japan relations, U.S.-Asia relations, China in particular, and with MITI, which viewed the things in a much more narrow fashion. It viewed things as in terms of national economic interests. For MITI, the concept of ODA was really quite limited to just provision of finance, the provision of guarantees, and the expansion of productive networks in the region. And this was reflected also in some of the sub-agencies involved in ODA. So you would see a split where JICA would side with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, right, in trying to push for a better defined agenda. And the OECF, which eventually becomes part of JBIC and then now is back with JICA, the OECF, which deals with the yen loan program, and that division sided with MITI in terms of a more narrow economic interest. And then also siding with MITI were a number of private sector interests and business interests. So you had the JICA and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs side trying to express the high road, right, that recipients should reduce arms trading, that they should be more transparent, and this would be something that Japan would emphasize, even more in a heightened fashion than other countries did at that point. One other sort of quick digression here. It was also at this point that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs start to pursue what Yasutoma calls the holy grail of a unified aid agency. They really believe that that having a unified aid agency would help to dispel some of the criticisms that were being thrown at Japan in terms of its aid. And they also believe that it would lead to more effective aid. But a lot of this was thwarted when the ideas for JBIC had emerged, because by 1995, the yen loan program, the OECF, had merged with the Export-Import Bank, and the Export-Import Bank had these deeper connections with the Ministry of Finance. And so this realignment of trying to put everything into one aid agency was thwarted, and this didn't happen until October of 2008. But I can tell you that the unification of the aid agency within JICA that occurred in October of 2008 had almost nothing to do with the sort of the original reasons for why Japanese aid should be unified in one agency. It had much more to do with, I think, inter-bureaucratic infighting. Nevertheless, doesn't mean that it won't lead to more effective aid, but that wasn't the motivation behind it. So the upshot of this is that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs largely prevailed in its attempts to align Japanese ODA with that of the international community interest, but there was still tension within with domestic demands, competing domestic demands, and with METI and JBIC representing the strengthening business interests in aid at this point. A quick view about the business community's ideas about ODA and their views on the merger itself, the merger that just occurred in 2008. Over time, Japan has been making drastic cuts in the amount of aid, particularly yen loan, soft yen loan aid, that is tied to any specific contracts by Japanese firms. In fact, depending on how you measure it, Japan has one of the lowest or one of the sort of, or is sort of average in terms of how it ties its aid, right? But most significantly, Japan is one of only a few countries in the world that actually will report the extent to which its aid is tied and will actually report the companies that get these contracts. You can find out, but with a great deal of difficulty, for instance, where the U.S., for instance, ties its aid through primarily through U.S. aid, but also through a number of other agencies. There's something called the Yellow Book. You can go and try and figure out, you know, who got what contract and so forth. But Japan is way more transparent in this way than a lot of other countries. But this has led to growing tension, of course, with the business community, because whereas the business community very strongly supported ODA back in the 60s and the 70s. By the 80s, as Japan was moving towards sort of these best practices that were being drawn up by the international aid community, it also meant that these guaranteed contracts were quickly disappearing. Right? So at this point, the business community's views on this merger were, look, it's okay if the yen side moves to JICA, and it's okay if Exim, you know, remains, export-import remains with JBIC, but we want assurances about one thing. What we want are assurances, for instance, that private sector participation in these projects is still going to be an opportunity for us, and they should be expanded, right? So at this point, METI was pushing actually quite hard for JBIC. This is when they were still merged. For JBIC, for instance, to go back to tying more aid. And this was something that took sort of a temporary leap in two periods. One period was immediately following the Asian financial crisis. There was a temporary leap in the number of contracts that were tied to ODA, and then it fell back down again. And then there was also another quick temporary leap following the tsunami, which I think was Christmas of 2004. Right, the thinking on that was that, look, we need to disperse this very, very quickly, and the quickest way of doing this is with firms that we already have a good relationship with, but you know, again, the level of tying fell back down. This was something that the business community really saw as a serious issue, and they pressed this with METI. But the other assurances they wanted were more risk guarantees, right? Primarily having to do with long-term financing of infrastructural projects. The major risks for them were non-payment, right, from the contractors, and the second major thing was currency risk, which I think they're right to worry about right now. They wanted an expansion of insurance protections from the government. Government guarantees basically expanding the scope of insurance protection and the length of the term of insurance protection. And they wanted the insurance to have increased compensation rates in case of project failure or project of some sort of project risk cropping up. They also wanted the government to be more engaged in the coordination of inputs into these major infrastructural projects. So one of the things that they were very concerned about was, for instance, this is just an example, you say you were building a power project in Indonesia. Well, that's fine if you can get most of the inputs into building this sort of thing, and you can get the guarantees, and you can get the insurance for that, but it does no good if you can't, for instance, guarantee adequate fuel supplies going into that power plant. And so there was a feeling that the government should step in to resolve any sort of coordination failures that might come about through the infrastructure. I think that's not a bad thing. I think this is, in fact, a very good thing, because you don't want these aid projects to be built in isolation. But this was is something that the private corporations, the business community, Kadon Ren in particular, felt was absolutely necessary for them to be able to back the idea of a unified aid agency. These bureaucratic alignments, by the way, are not always that consistent. I'm making it sound as if that there were these clear divisions, but it often changed according to issue area. So, for instance, all the ministries were unified on the instance of giving aid to Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union to Boris Yeltsin. They were all opposed to it. Right? Even the Ministry of Foreign Affairs didn't see a whole lot of return coming to Japan for giving aid to Russia. Nevertheless, they were pressured by the U.S. and were fearful of what would happen with the collapse of the Yeltsin regime. So while they were unified on Russia, they were divided on the issue of resuming aid to China after the Tiananmen incident in 1989. I mean, all countries wanted to jump back in and give aid to China. It wasn't just Japan. In fact, Japan wasn't even the first one to go back in. I think the French were the first one to go back in, just within months, anyway, of June of 1989. But here, the ministries were fairly split on the issue of whether to resume aid to China and when to resume aid, with the Ministry of Finance strongly favoring a quick return to the ODA program in China, and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and METI being much more cautious about this because they felt that the repercussions from doing so from the U.S. would be too much. These changes that were made in 1992 and then subsequently with the 2003 revision of the ODA Charter stress some items that I think really impinge on these two principles that Japan has traditionally held. One is of non-interference, and one is and the other dealing with request-based aid. The guidelines leading up to the 2003 revision was that Japan needed to be much more efficient and much more transparent, that there should be more participatory implementation of ODA, and that it needed to get the buy-in of the public in Japan and in the recipient and or host countries. But this meant that these first expressions of for instance, greater transparency, support for democratization, and so forth, was one of the first indicators of a growing contradiction between Japanese stated aid philosophy and actual practice in subsequent documents. So, for instance, when human rights entered the picture, that's a direct interference in the political domestic affairs of recipient countries, or issues of the environment. Not only is that an interference into to domestic political affairs, but it's also it also contradicts the principle of request-based aid. If you're now programming a portion of your budget to go specifically into environmental projects, and you're consulting with the use of Japanese experts environmental projects that you want to see delivered. And I'm not saying this is a bad thing, but this is, again, a growing contradiction within the aid philosophy of Japan. You're no longer strictly dealing with a request-based aid system. What you are now dealing with is a hybrid request and programmatic system for giving aid. A quick idea of domestic splits involved in the revision of the 2003 ODA charter. Three major groups in Japan, domestic groups, I think. I know this is a really clumsy way of labeling them. I'll have to figure out some other way of labeling them. But you can divide them generally into these multilateralists who have drunk the international aid community's Kool-Aid, right? That they view, they buy into this idea of best practices and so forth. I would categorize these people as probably the most faddish kinds of aid supporters. So if good institutions and good governance is the style of the day, that's what they support. Or if they want to do poverty reduction studies, that's the style of the day. Then you also have these bilateralists or strategists who view aid as being important for prestige, obviously, but they're much more instrumental in how they view it. They view this as necessary from a larger perspective of national interests, and in particular security interests. Right. So these are the people who say, well, okay, that's fine if you want to give aid for poverty reduction, but we need to think about our larger interests here, and we need to deploy aid in multiple objectives. And the third, I think, have the narrowest view of what aid should be. And this is the dumbest label that I have, and I really need something better than this. But the reciprocalists. These are the narrowest interests in the sense that, look, there has to be a quid pro quo, right? If we give aid, we want something back. So these would be the followers of the Hans Morgenthau school of foreign aid. Look, it's really just a bribe. Foreign aid is a bribe, right? But in order for this bribe to work, you got to give us something in return. So these were the groups that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs had to wrangle, had to herd in order to get a revision of the charter through. But in addition to that, they had to face a number of other realities. This chart just simply shows the flows of ODA over time and billions of dollars. And one of the things, of course, one of the emerging constraints here had to do with Japan's fiscal constraints. even though there was a slight recovery in 2008, and I think sometime in the next week or two, they should publish the 2009 figures. After ODA peaked in the mid-90s, it's sort of been undergoing a contraction. And again, 2005 is sort of an anomaly dealing with the aftermath of the tsunami. The other sort of constraints that the 2003 revision had to deal with was, of course, the newer topic of terrorism and conflict in the world. And so the charter mentions this specifically. So it's, again, in response to a particular change in the international environment. It's a response to sort of the global ideological fads of the day. Is reflected in its specific statements about aid being targeted towards poverty reduction and, in particular, the reduction of inequality in the world. And then third, something that actually dates much earlier, back to the 1980s, but is much more explicit in this 2003 revision, is Japan's commitment to environmental and sustainable growth. Right? The motivation is a bit different from the motivations back in the 1980s. but it's much more clearly articulated in the 2003 charter as before. In other ways, it hadn't changed at all. Right? So despite the fact that you have these new expressions of interest in poverty reduction and the environment and so forth, Japan's the ODA charter still explicitly talks about how Japan is heavily dependent on the outside world for resources, energy, and food, and will proactively contribute to the stability and development of developing countries through its ODA. So, again, the expression is not wholly bought into this idea of an altruistic vision of aid. Instead, there is a balance of support for what Japan views as global goods, right? But it's also national strategy that's involved here, because there is this explicit mention that Japan's ODA strategy is consistent with Japan's need for security, so whether it's food security or other kinds of security and need for resources, this is all mentioned. Self-help is still mentioned as one of the things, fairness and the use of Japanese experience and expertise. And it really did nothing else to dispel critics' concerns that Japan was prioritizing Asia over every other region. This has not really changed at all, even though Japan gave greater emphasis, for instance, to the Central Asian and Caucasus regions and also to Africa. And it sort of pulled back, for instance, in Latin America, which it felt was largely well off, and in Oceania, which was on a case-by-case Reed Whaling, UN Security Council case. It strayed again back into this area that, look, you know, you have to recognize that Asia is important to Japan, right? And not only politically and economically, but just because this is where our deep engagement is. This is also further constrained by, I have to slip something in about postal savings, largely, the funding sources have changed over time, but that, you know, to the extent that Japanese aid is sustainable, it's sustainable only through constant reinjections of capital into the yen loan program. So just to look at the soft yen loan operations only, a good deal of this is dependent on government borrowing. Government-guaranteed bonds that JICA itself or JBIC will issue, and occasional capital injections, annual capital injections to maintain the fund. So the idea that there's going to be any sort of growth taking place in Japanese ODA, I think, is becoming less, less, I think, of a possibility. Finally, I just want to turn to something here about how Japanese aid is judged by the rest of the world. Back when I was in JBIC, there was a big deal being made about the Center for Global Development's Commitment to Development Index. And countless papers were written by Japanese academics on why it was unfair. And what I was trying to tell my colleagues there at the time was, well, it's not exactly measuring what you think it's measuring, right? If you actually look at the components of this Commitment to Development Index, look, it's unfair. How can you judge generosity as an interest rate spread, right, between what our loans are and what our market loans are? Japan has a 0% interest rate. How much more generous can we get than that, right? They had a point there, but I think in defense of the CGD, I don't think that they were really meaning to measure aid effectiveness. They were looking to measure a general commitment to development in the world at large. Nevertheless, it's often used as if it were a proxy measure. This is something else. This is a new study out by Brookings, done by William Easterly and Todd Futsa. Futsa. But it ranks Japan actually quite high. And it ranks Japan very close to a couple of the Nordic group countries as a bilateral donor. It's fairly highly ranked in terms of best practices in aid, on a number of different things. And I think you can measure these things in all different ways. And this is exactly the problem, I think, that I'm trying to point at today, is that depending on how you construct your indices and how you define your terms, you can come up with some very, very disparate rankings of how anyone is doing. And how do you measure aid quality, and how do you measure aid effectiveness? So, you know, in the early 2000s, the debate was really about how, official aid, official financing was going to crowd out private financing. And I think that you know, in this current situation, and then also in the situation following the Asian financial crisis, the conversation starts to turn towards whether there's a crowding in effect. And Tom here probably could say a little bit more about this, but what a lot of banks that are involved in project financing, and there aren't any here in the U.S., but banks who are involved in project financing want are assurances, right? They want assurances about the risks, because these are often very long-term loans that have to be made for infrastructural development. And there are country risks, political risks, economic risks, all sorts of risks involved, actual project risks themselves in the implementation of the project. And unless you have sort of a lender or insurer of last resort, I think a lot of private investors would be quite hesitant to get into the game. The only major players left involved in major infrastructural financing for low-income countries, that is, the high-risk countries, are the European Development Fund and JICA and World Bank. And even the World Bank is cutting back on a lot of this. And other bilateral donors started moving away from infrastructural aid some time ago. So the newer scholarship on this area, I think, leads to a number of doubts about whether or not all these prescriptions that have come out in recent years through the international aid community have actually been worthwhile. One is that there's a whole new set of studies that have come out in the last few years throwing a good deal of doubt on whether we actually know what the causal mechanisms of economic growth are. So as it turns out, we don't know whether, controlling population growth or increasing tertiary education levels or, gender equality or investment or a number of other things actually leads to growth. A lot of this stuff is too vulnerable to changes in the data itself. Worst of all, for the aid regime, and this is part of this larger debate that, the sort of hot debate between Easterly and Sachs and all that, about whether we know whether aid has actually done any good in this world. Right. On the Easterly side, you say, well, no, because aid has been all about planning and not searching. And in the case of Sachs, well, no, because we haven't been giving enough aid. We still don't know about whether aid has worked at all. And more importantly, we don't know what kinds of aid, if aid is effective at all, we don't know what kinds of aid have been effective. Now, there is growing evidence that infrastructural aid in middle-income countries, and even in low-income countries in some instances, can lead to economic growth. But more work has to be done on that to confirm this. And if that's the case, then all these bad practices that Japan has engaged in over these years have actually been good practices. Right? So Japan has not been especially fashionable in the world of international development and aid, but it may have been more right than wrong in a lot of instances. The other things that I think are also important, because these are things that Japan also have always had much more skepticism about than many other donors, is whether or not conditionality worked. Japan has always been a little bit skeptical about the idea of placing conditionality on aid. And again, more recent scholarship shows that conditionality has in fact not worked because it's too easy to skirt them. And the idea that you need to get out of the markets because private capital markets will fulfill the demand for long-term loans. Well, this hasn't happened. Bond markets have collapsed in the past, and they will collapse again. And it's clear that private capital markets won't fill the demand, especially for the high-risk, lower-income countries, unless you have certain government guarantees. right? And then finally, and this is the thing that I think Japan has gotten a whole lot of criticism for, is its opposition to large-scale debt relief. Japan doesn't come out and say that it opposes debt relief, but again, it's been very skeptical about debt relief because, as one JBIC officer said to me, well, so we forgive all of our debts, and these countries will go right back out, sometimes onto the private markets, sometimes to China, sometimes to Saudi Arabia, and they will replace those debts, but this time they will replace them with lower quality debts that may not have an element of forgiveness in them that we, have, or without the level of expertise that comes. When JBIC gives a loan, or now JICA gives a loan to countries, or when the World Bank gives a loan to countries for infrastructural projects, it comes as a package. It comes with a number of experts. It comes with expertise and engineering and so forth and planning that these other loans. So it's really bad debt chasing out the good debt. And I think the more recent evidence is that's really been the case, is that especially with highly indebted poor countries and the need for them to meet certain thresholds and so forth, and having to lower the thresholds each and every time, have meant that these countries have then fled to poorer quality debt obligations than had they stuck with a repayment plan that I think Japan and France had favored, rather than pushing for debt relief. I'm going to stop here. I really just had one more thing, but that I think we'll leave that for discussion.
Thanks. I think we have about a little over 15 minutes.
Okay.
To take questions. That was very, very interesting, especially at the end when you sort of put it in perspective and contrasted fashionable to effective or good. On the very first slide, you talked about different motivations attributed to Japan, mercantilist and reactive and so on and so forth. You could, part of the sort of futility of political science scholarship on this is that you could draw a very, very clean, clear correlation. If you looked at the ODA list and who was at the top over the past 40 years mm-hmm. or 50 years, you could draw very clear correlations between socialization to international trends, Japan's commercial interests. JBIC, for at least three decades, has surveyed industry and asked, where do you plan to invest? And the yen loans generally track with what people in industry say. So there's your correlation, maybe even your causality about the commercial interests. But you could also look at the top of the ODA list. It was Southeast Asia until the 78 and the friendship treaty with China. Mm-hmm. And then China grew up by the early 80s to the top ranks. And then in the 90s, China fell off, and India and Vietnam rose, which is an exact correlation with Japan's geostrategic interests. In the 78 treaty on, it was balancing the Soviets and stabilizing relations with China. Before that, it was building up Southeast Asia, which is exactly what the U.S. wanted. And then the outreach to India and Vietnam is part of a sort of soft balancing strategy with China. That also happens to be exactly in the interest of commerce. So I suppose it's okay for the commercial and geostrategic interests to converge. In fact, given that Japan's power in the world is commercial, that you would almost expect that. That's just an observation you can agree with or disagree with. You mentioned yesterday Susan Strange and structural influence. Mm-hmm. And, I wonder if you could say just a little bit more, based on your last observation, about whether you think Japan is getting credit or is effectively making an intellectual case based on your last insight, which is, after decades of criticism, it turns out that the scholarship is kind of catching up and the expertise is sort of catching up to what Japan's been doing all along, which is infrastructure. Or is Japan just not leveraging that?
Yeah, let me answer that first and go back to the first thing. In fact, Japan is terrible at it. and I'm not even saying that Japan knew what it was doing. It sort of sometimes in stubbornness you end up with the right solutions, even though, it may, again, be for national strategic reasons. That doesn't mean that they're wrong. It just means that you may not have had the right motives behind it. And I think if you're really worried about stuff like economic growth and poverty reduction, you can't care so much about the motives. And in fact, you should care more about what the right outcomes are. And Japan could be doing a much better job, and particularly the Japanese academic community could be doing a much better job at disseminating the kinds of studies that I know go on. The Japanese government has done a lot of work in the last couple decades to establish, for instance, GRIPS, for instance, was established in part to deal with the increased need for these experts, right, in areas like development and strategy and security and so forth. And a number of other agencies or initiatives like FACID to deal with, monitoring, evaluation, and those sorts of things. So it's not as if there aren't people, scholars and practitioners in the field, who aren't looking at these issues and who aren't deeply engaged in the scholarship of economic growth and poverty reduction and so forth. But you rarely see them at international conferences. You very rarely see them being published in the major journals in the field. And oftentimes you don't even see the stuff being published in English. And you need to do that in order to do. So part of this is, I think, a need for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and now JICA to do a much more effective job at marketing. Now, JICA's actually always done a better job, and particularly when Ogata came to JICA, they did a much better public relations job, but it was to highlight the software aspects of aid. So this would be, to do these heartwarming NHK documentaries where you send an actress to a poor village in India and their happy children around a school and that sort of thing, or looking at the bright, shiny new Delhi Metro. Much less in sort of the more hardcore scholarship that says, look, what do we actually know about the relationship between aid and economic growth? And, these people are actually making important contributions. They're just not getting disseminated. So that's one thing. I was going to add one more correlation to this that problem is disentangling the correlations here between Japanese motivations for aid and U.S. strategic reasons for aid and economic reasons for aid. And one more is that, what you mentioned here, this sort of focus on Southeast Asia and then a focus on China and now a focus on the Mekong Delta and India and so forth, they also correlate very highly with the rate of growth in these countries. It will take a little bit more, I think, work to see, again, whether or not, that I think a lot of work that's very important that I think is worth looking at again is the work that a lot of Japanese economists have done in looking at the relationship between Japanese investment in these regions and the subsequent growth, right? Both productive networks and finance. Right.
Other questions?
I'm Bob Hershey. I wondered how Japan is doing compared to other countries in transparency and getting a lot of these things on the internet so everybody can see it and perhaps make their own figures of merit.
That's right. They are doing much better. So 5 years ago, you could hardly find anything on the internet with respect to either particular projects or data. You could go to the OECD, OECD.org, at any point to get mostly aggregate statistics. Starting about 5 years ago, when JBIC did a site design of their website, it was much easier. You could actually go back to the JBIC website and download annual reports, you could download statistics, so there's a lot more transparency. And as I said, Japan has become much more transparent about, for instance, what specific corporations are getting contracts, you know, and what portion of those contracts go to developing country companies. So I think, and this is again the Easterly Foot Study. If you look at that here, the way in which they measured transparency with the 62% was whether or not their phone calls were answered. So they dialed up these agencies and asked them, could you answer a few questions about aid? And so if they returned their call, they automatically got a certain number of points. And then if they could respond or give information about, you know, specific things like how many employees do you have, how many projects do you have, how much, you know, this and that. So whereas Japan isn't very high on the list in terms of transparency, it's certainly a lot better than it used to be, right? And that's only just one indicator. You made the phone call, somebody answered the phone. That was, you know, again, and they admit this was, you know, this was sort of a study on the fly, right? But it does overturn some conventional ideas about Japanese responsiveness, right?
I think our Foreign Minister Okada has commissioned another review of the ODA. He's commissioned another review of the Japan's ODA policy. Mm-hmm. And the situations, I think, the current economic political situation in Japan sort of seems to mirror the crisis atmosphere that existed in 1992. In your presentation, you've suggested that the international community had a lot to do with pressuring Japan to sort of conform. Is that still, do you think, the prime influencer or predominant force that may be reshaping Japan's policy in the future, or has the world moved on to China, and can we just sort of sit back now?
Well, certainly China has done a good job of diverting criticism away from Japan, and now the international aid community can spend all of its time disrespecting China's aid policies. I think Japan still gets a lot of criticism. I think some of it is warranted. I'm not saying that not all of it is warranted. I'm just saying that the targets for criticism have to be much more focused than they've been. You can't just paint Japanese aid with a broad brushstroke and say Japanese aid is bad because it goes to infrastructure, or Japanese aid is bad because it goes to middle-income countries. I think you have to look at specific practices. And I think that's where I don't know what this current administration is going to be doing, whether or not the DPJ even has a coherent policy about ODA. If the foreign minister is engaging in this, I haven't seen a whole lot of specifics about what Okada has in mind. And I don't even know if they're going to have much time left to formulate a coherent ODA strategy. You know, if you look at specific practices, there's lots of areas of criticism, but that can be said of almost any country, including the Nordic group countries. If you look at it at the aggregate, I think it's not so bad. It doesn't look quite as bad. And I think that's what the international aid community has to take into account, is that you can't keep criticizing a donor for practices that you can't actually prove are bad, right? In the same way that they haven't been able, for instance, to demonstrate that their best practices, right, supporting good institutions, good governance, rule of law, that sort of thing, has done any good for growth or for poverty reduction. It may be good for other reasons, but for the purposes of reducing poverty or increasing economic growth, the evidence is not all that clear.
It's rather than a question. My thoughts I've been thinking about whether the private sector can contribute more to this assistance. You mentioned about the so-called project finance. Those ODAs needs a lot of political or strategic or national interest viewpoint. But if private sector can contribute, maybe what the viability of the project, say infrastructure itself, whether it's maximum use of money, maximum use of taxpayers' money in the advanced nations. What I mean is, if we build, say, bridges, bridge needs to be used. You know, the bridge is nowhere in Alaska or in rural Japan, but as far as we build something in the developing countries, those infrastructure needs to be, or wanted, we wanted this to be maximized to for the public safety or the economic development. And in that sense, project financing in private sector can provide the real viability based on market mechanism. And that may give more effectiveness of the infrastructure investment and the ODA itself. So it's only part of that, not the whole picture of the ODA, but that may be a case for the public sector's view.
I have heard that view expressed by some members of the Keidanren and also the Bankers Association, that, look, you know, these are countries that not only want this infrastructure built, they actually need this. And to make a national interest argument for this, you know, building a bridge in the Philippines, for instance, not only is going to help the local economy, but in the long run it will help the regional economy, right? The problem is, again, you know, the political problem, again, is whether or not the pressures are there then to award these contracts to Japanese firms or to American firms. And unlike, for instance, banking, and these firms are international, right? They're multinational and so forth, but there are much clearer sort of flags over something like Bechtel, right, or Sumitomo, or, you know, these major construction companies. And so I think the pressure from the international community is consistent in terms of wanting to maintain or to push donors to continue untying their loans. The pressure in Japan, again, coming from the business federations and the banking federations, is much stronger to go the other way. And, I don't know to the extent that the current... there have been, again, these sort of anecdotal bits that say that, the DPJ is going to be just as wound up with corporations as the LDP is. And then there are other stories that say, well, no, they just haven't done the groundwork in order to get these relationships tied up. But since we don't know what's going to happen to the DPJ, it's hard to know what's going to happen with ODA. Right?
Do you think ODA is I mean, the other variable that explains, if not the direction of ODA and especially yen loans, that at least explains the rhetoric and the government philosophy is domestic, not business, but political pressure. People like Kono Taro saying, I want to cut ODA in half and so forth. And now that you just mentioned it with the DPJ, I'm not sure, maybe Nick or others know, if the DPJ took on JICA or JPIC or others in the Gyosei Zashin Kaigi in these public show trials. I don't know. Did they? They did? Pretty public, and was it pretty brutal? Yeah. They bashed. Okato, yeah. So there's part of your answer on the DPJ, which means that they're going to be under pressure to articulate the logic of aid in ways that, the Maritime Self-Defense Forces was smart. They had a light aircraft carrier, and they just renamed it the UI. And suddenly, Hotemo was in favor of it. So there are ways to get around this. But that's going to be a whole other source of pressure, I would think. To justify aid.
Yeah, I think again the you'll see the problems at the margins, and the margins are important. There was an increase in the aid budget last year, and I think that I haven't seen what 2009 is. As I said, I think next week they'll publish the new things. I'm a little bit it's. The show trial aspect of this is very interesting because, at least in the in the office that I was sitting in. I mean, these people were paid nothing. they were paid nothing to do this very difficult work. They were each handling multiple projects. Japan is one of the leanest aid bureaucracies in the world, and it's even leaner when you think about the amount of disbursements they have to make, right? And that sort of partially explains the bias towards large-scale infrastructure because you don't have the aid proliferation, you know, of other humanitarian sorts of projects. But it's a shame.
The GPJs, you know, Jacobin trials of the bureaucrats, I think, are just, you know, the worst kind of populism and damaging to Japan's national interest and the GPJ itself. But did you see in the Washington Post this morning that 7 people sought political asylum in Canada after the Olympics, and 2 of them were Japanese? And I'm wondering if they're from JICA. Anyway, thank you very much, Maria. Terrific. You're around the rest of the week, right?
I am, just Friday.
And until Friday, right. That is the rest of the week.
Yeah.
We have to conclude here. I don't know if we have to give up the room, but you're free to stick around and chat with people as you like. Terrific. Thanks.
Thank you.